Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And this is KHOI Community Radio, which is why you're hearing us in the first place. Yes, it is. We just went through a Labor Day weekend. Hats off to all laborers, and remember that it's been a long struggle to get paid for your labor. And, we're still working on that, but we had a lovely Labor Day weekend. This time of year, we are blessed with bounty. Gardens are booming. Stuff is people. Time of year where people put boxes of things on your back steps because they just have too much zucchini. We have too much trouble here. Tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, okra, zucchini. Now is the time to think about putting food by, saving things.
It's a glut. We have a glut.
A glut. And a glut is good. That's how the natural world works. I mean, things bloom and then we've got the cold, dark winter ahead of us. And if the human species ever survives, we tend to learn from our mistakes and put food by for the wintertime. So, joining us at the kitchen table today is Kate Gilbert. Welcome, Kate.
Yes, Kate is the Associate Professor of Teaching at ISU in Food Service, formerly known as Home Economics. Welcome, Kate. You're going to help us sort out some of these canning questions.
Yes, thanks for having me. We're excited to talk about canning today because, like you, there's lots of vegetables at home that are getting canned right now.
Yeah. And a lot of people learn from their mom, learn from their grandma, but there has been a small kerfuffle happening.
Yes, I would call it a tempest in the teapot here.
But Ball Canning Company, the Ball Company that has made for ages, actually over 100 years now, has been making jars and the canning lids that go on top of it. People rely on them. Many years ago, they put out something called the Ball Blue Book of Canning or something like that. And people use that as kind of the standard. You want to kind of check up on your methods here. But recently, there was something that was kind of a red flag or something. Tell us, Kate, what went on with that?
Well, so I think this has been brewing for a while, but recently the Iowa State Extension has stopped recommending the Ball Blue Book for 4-H projects. So if you're a kid in 4-H and you want to make something canned to take to the county fair to be evaluated, now you need to follow USDA recommendations for canning instead of the Ball Blue Book. And that's where this kerfuffle or kind of controversy started.
I like the word kerfuffle. But anyway, oh, goodness. So does the USDA have a canning book, too, or a canning something to refer to?
Yes. So the USDA canning, it's free. It's PDFs online. Some of it's been updated over time. But it's probably not quite as diverse as the recipes involved in the book. But I did spend some time looking through, and it's not too far off. So essentially, these recipes with the canning time have been verified to make sure they're safe. Ball Blue Book may be doing that. They're just not sharing their testing methods. And so that's what's led to questions. As extension services, any recommendation has to be based on science. It has to be based on data. It has to be proved, right, to be able to put your recommendation on it. And the issue here is that Ball Blue Book has not shared enough information for Iowa State Extension to be able to endorse it for recipes for 4-H.
My concern about the kerfluffle was that when the information came out and the national publicity actually featured an ISU food science professor, I think my initial alarm was there was a lot of criticism of the Ball Blue Book. I get really unhappy when I feel like the average eater has been discouraged from cooking at home. That's my big thing. I think we all need to feel we need to. There's no such thing as too much home cooking, right? So my initial alarm was that they just criticized without offering reassurances. So you are here to undo that for us and to tell us what, you know, what we need to do. I mean, I'm skeptical because, of course, it's like one institution is taking over the superiority of knowledge here. I'm not sure that Blue Book canning is really that egregious. My guess could be that those recipes are so old that they may not have kept the records on what they're doing. But obviously, as a corporation, they need to update that. So you tell us, what is the big deal? Let's go straight to botulism.
All right, here we go. So, and here's the thing, is that the recipes in Ball Blue Book may be okay. They just haven't proven that they're safe. And the biggest thing here is botulism. And as a food scientist, there aren't very many bacteria, yeast, or molds that I'm scared of, but Clostridium botulinum makes the list. It's the top one. It's the scariest. It's the biggest concern.
And it can make people drop dead. It's not like your stomach is going to rumble a little bit. It's bad. Bad.
Treatment has gotten a lot better, but if you don't die, you could still be in the hospital a long time. You could still be paralyzed. You could still have lasting effects from having botulism. So it's not something to mess around with. Taken very seriously, and really that's what all of this is going to be revolving around in terms of proving that it's safe to kill. So Clostridium botulinum is the bacteria that causes botulism toxin. It spores, so it's kind of dormant state, lives in soil, lives all over the place.
Everywhere. It's not like you have to have do something bad to bring it into the house, like salmonella or something. It's there.
Yep. And it will not turn into a vegetative cell that's going to produce the toxin unless it's in an anaerobic condition, which means no oxygen is present.
So if it's in canning, then it gets,
So that's why we're not concerned about the carrot that just came out of the ground that you washed the dirt off of. You know, there's probably botulism, Clostridium botulinum spores there, but you're not going to get sick from it because there's air, there's oxygen present. So it's not until we put it into a can and put a lid on where we've taken out some
and let it sit a while.
And what happens then if you don't get enough heat to kill those spores? And spores are really resistant. It's going to take a lot of heat. We'll talk about that.
It's above boiling temperature that you have to go. What is it? 230 for a sustained period of time.
121 degrees Celsius or 250 degrees Fahrenheit for at least 3 minutes.
250 at 3 minutes. If you're going to remember that, that's really important.
But we'll talk about it. It's more complicated than that because it has to be the coolest part in the jar. Has that much heat for that amount of time. My dad was asking questions. Well, isn't there just an easy formula? And I go, no, Dad. This is product specific. This is jar size specific. It's very specific on how much time that's actually going to look like in your pressure canner. But that's what you need to be able to kill the spores.
And you do need a pressure canner because hot water baths will not go above the boiling temperature of water.
Right. And we're going to talk about history a little bit. My grandmother and great aunt definitely hot water bath stuff that could have had Clostridium in it, and they just cooked the bejesus out of it for a really long time. And that's a possibility, but still a little risky. So the recommendation now is all pressure canner for anything that could have botulism. So the piece here where it gets confusing but also makes some things easier is that this spore is only going to grow in what we call low acid. And so that's more pH neutral foods.
For example,
the cutoff is a pH of 4.6. So anything more acidic than that is going to be fine. The botulism spores can't grow.
All right. Kate, tell us what is considered low acid and what is considered safe. Like, I've done jams and jellies with Hot Pack for years. Not dangerous.
And that's perfectly safe. Almost all fruit has a pH or it's acidic enough that Clostridium botulinum spores are not going to grow. I think one of the only fruits that is not below that 4.6 pH or not acidic enough is bananas, but I can't think about when you would.
Who would want a can of banana? Can of banana.
So berries, apple, pears, anything really around here fruit-wise that we would can is going to be acidic enough that we can hot water bath can, and we're not going to be worried about clostridium.
Now, what about tomatoes?
Vegetables are the concern. And we're going to talk about tomatoes because tomatoes are kind of a case of progression in what we've learned over time. So your green beans, your carrots, pretty much any vegetable you're going to want to pressure can, unless it's been pickled. So that's kind of your...
Oh, right. Pickles. So, pickles are okay, right? Because the vinegar changes the pH drastically.
Yes. So anything pickled with enough vinegar can also be hot water bath, or anything fermented. So we just started our sauerkraut to ferment, and that will be acidic enough when we go to can that hot water bath.
But let me ask you, once you've made your own sauerkraut, if you can it, does that not kill the beneficial organisms as well?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a trade-off. So you get the beneficial organisms to do the fermentation and get you the really great flavor, and then we need it to last. That's just how our family makes sauerkraut. It's every 2 years, so we make in bulk. And so that canning is important.
2 years, woof. Okay.
It's a hassle. You do about 25 pounds every other year, and that gets us by.
That ought to do her. Yes, sirree.
Everybody has their own sauerkraut strategy. That just happens to be ours.
Good.
So what this means, and we're going to talk a little bit about the canning piece and why even the hot water bath is important, but anything that's fruit, anything that's pickled with their hot water bath is going to be safe. So we are concerned about if you're canning meat, if you're canning vegetables using the pressure canner. So right away, that takes off, you know, probably 2/3 of the recipes in the Ball Blue Book are probably okay. We still need proof, but probably okay, because botulism is not going to be that concern. Your concern is spoilage microorganisms. That's why you're still heating. That's why you're still sterilizing jars, doing the cleaning of the
food. And let's say if even if you've hot packed or put something on the shelf and it's sitting there and, you know, 6 months later you open it up and it looks funny or it smells funny.
Or it can kind of start exploding.
Yeah. Here's my motto. If in doubt, don't. You know, inspect those things before you eat them. And I know it's sad, but, you know, once in a while you don't seal it properly and you have to throw it away.
And that's a good principle. That's written, I think, probably in the Ball Blue Book. It's written on the USDA recommendations. You know, if there's any questions, throw it out. The big piece about Clostridium botulinum and whether, you know, botulism toxin is there is it's not like it's gas forming or...
Right. Botulism, you cannot necessarily see. You cannot necessarily taste. It might look fine. It might taste fine. And then you've poisoned Aunt Grace the next moment. You know, I mean, not good.
So let's talk about tomatoes. I think tomatoes are a great example of how things have changed over time and how really I know that Ball Blue Book is using some sort of recommendations here. So long ago, tomatoes, there probably weren't as many varieties as you could grow in the garden as there are now. I don't know how many there are now, but hundreds, right?
Especially in Lana's garden.
They tended to be a little bit more acidic. We now know we like some varieties that are a little less acidic, you know, so our pH of the tomato range is wider than what you
like need. The yellow ones are low acid tomatoes. You need to know that. Right?
Generally, yeah.
Yeah.
Generally.
Mm-hmm.
So longer ago, they assumed fairly acidic tomatoes. They assumed botulism was not really a risk. There was no recommendation when you went to can the tomatoes to add any lemon juice, which is a recommendation now to ensure that the pH is below that 4.6 or that you don't have to worry about botulism.
And can you use pH strips to just test that?
You can. You can. pH strips, especially if you've got any color in the liquid, are not always as accurate
right.
as you want
Hello.
To be.
Okay.
So it works, but it can be a little fuzzy. And they're just assuming that not many people have a pH probe at home. Right.
You can buy pH strips and they're cheap, but a pH probe is a whole nother dimension and equipment. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have an old Ball Blue Book that one of my faculty colleagues used to take to class, and I can't remember. I couldn't find it if it was from the 40s or 50s, but the process time on those tomatoes was like 20 minutes and not pressure canner, just hot
20,
water bath.
20 minutes hot bath. Hot.
Yes. Yeah. That was it. Whereas now they recommend for quart jars, 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, and 1 hour and 25 minutes per quart.
Woo, holy cats.
And so that's a huge update. And part of that has been tomatoes, you know, that there are more varieties and they can't specify what type of tomato and what acidity it should be at. But that's also a huge range that I assume has to do with them learning more. And the story gets a little bit crazier. I don't know exactly which Ball Blue Book reference my grandmother was using, but usually with like stewed tomatoes, they go in my chili or they go in soup and they get heated up one more time, which will deactivate the toxin. My grandmother just served stewed tomatoes eaten cold right out of the jar to her family growing up. And you think, whoa. Well, obviously, everyone survived, right? So her tomatoes were probably acidic enough. It was probably fine. But you don't want to play around with being wrong on anything that could cause botulism.
Well, my remedy is freeze. I've been freezing tomato, you know, cooking the tomatoes down into sauce and freezing them for a long time. First of all, I did it because I'm lazy. Canning, you know, at those temperatures for that length of time in the hot weather is, I'm lazy, okay? But freezing is just fine.
Yeah. Freezing is fine. I mean, you have some pros and cons there, right? You have to keep your freezer running for the entire time that you have, you know, those vegetables in there.
Right.
You might run out of space. I have so many things. I'm lazy too. A lot of fruits.
I have two freezers, okay?
And my little chest freezer is to the top, and everything else has to be canned from here on out. Because
Kate,
I can't
just get another freezer. That's what I did.
I'm trying to hold out, but that would be a solution. So, you know, canning is shelf stable, and I think that's a huge benefit, and it's where it would have started out. So, can I talk a little bit of history? This is one of my favorite food science facts.
Oh, good.
One of these.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Okay, great. So this is part folklore, and I did try to prove it out. But this is one of the fun things you learn as a beginning food science student, and it's about Napoleon and canning.
Ah, yes.
Which seems crazy, but overall, if you look through history, it is amazing how many times war has moved food knowledge forward, be it processing or food products and what have you. So the story goes that Napoleon, he might not have quite been in charge yet, but the French army was losing more of its troops to bad food than it was to the actual war. I don't know if that's actually true. I don't know if it's the amount of food. I don't know if they're malnourished or if they could really prove that it was food safety issues. I'm not really sure, but that's how the story goes. And so they put out a challenge and prize money, so 12,000 francs, for anybody to figure out how to produce safe food. So in walks Nicolas Appert, and he was a confectioner, a candy maker. And the rumors were that he was a pretty good candy maker, but he was bad with money. And so he needed that prize money probably to keep himself afloat. But he was determined. He spent forever on this. The award went out, or the challenge went out in 1795, and he didn't get that prize money until like 1810. But he looked at wine, and he knew wine lasted. He knew it was in bottles, and he knew there was a cork.
And it could travel, so, yeah.
Yes. So he replicated that system, and it took a while to figure out. He usually had to put some wax or something over the cork, so it was a sealed system. And then he did different time, temperature, heating to figure out what was safe. I don't know how he figured out it was safe. Like, if somebody had to eat stuff, I'm not really sure how this worked to prove out. That would not be a good
I suppose you could feed it to a mouse or something, right?
Maybe. But there's rumors, like, that he canned an entire sheep at some point, which I don't even know how he could draw that big. But I love the idea that was
my.
But he got the award. The Navy, French Navy, tested it out, like, 1806. And that was a big deal to figure out at that point in time, because it'd be 50 years before Louis Pasteur came around to be able to explain.
Ah.
They really had no idea, but were still able to figure out how to produce safe food through canning.
Pragmatic, weren't they?
Oh my goodness.
I know. Nicolas Appert is a name you know. He's listed as the father of canning. There's awards in a professional organization named after him. And so it's just a fun story that I think has been embellished over time, but it's still fascinating nonetheless.
Huh. So this brings us to the canning jar. It seems I recall a special on PBS or something that when this man was doing his testing and vying for the prize, that he was putting vegetables in wine bottles because they're strong and they can be boiled. And
the French had wine bottles.
And they had wine bottles. There was something. Oh, they unearthed a wine bottle from a cellar someplace, and it was full of peas as opposed to wine. And I don't think they were very edible. It was probably the kind of gray peas that we get in cans now. But
peas don't improve with age the way wine does.
Oh, my goodness. This is great. Yeah, we haven't been putting things in cans in a while. Before canning came along, we survived over the winter by what? By salting things? By
drying.
Yeah.
Fermentation.
Yeah.
There were whole cultures that buried things like grains to keep the bugs out. And
butchering your animals in the fall and hanging them out in the cold.
Well, yeah. For example, prosciutto, which we all love, is an example of a dried product that can hang. It has to. That's why you butcher in the fall, because the temperatures are cooler. It has to be at a certain temperature. It's a whole nother food science project, and it is highly controlled. I know that when Herb Eckhaus started La Quercia, he wanted to replicate the traditional Italian way of curing prosciutto here in Iowa. He had to jump through hoops with the USDA to get his certification because, you know, there's a lot of, well, it looks unscientific, you know. You roll the ham there in some cornmeal and you hang it up to dry, you know. Well, as a matter of fact, it has to be a certain temperature range, certain humidity range. And, you know, if you're not in Tuscany and you're in Iowa, there's some different things to negotiate. But he did it and is producing really fine prosciutto here.
It works. Evidently, the human race has survived.
We don't know about the ones that didn't survive.
True. That's true.
They get awfully quiet.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about. And, okay, so we started out with the Napoleonic Wars, okay? When did things turn into metal cans? I mean, canning in cans.
Yeah, I have to look up the year, but it's probably 10 or 15 years after Nicolas de Pere could explain what was happening that the first tin can came around. So that was kind of the next step after that to get canning started. So if you kind of line things up, you know, just one thing after another, I think experimentation each of those times and wild, wild west of experimenting before you could explain what was happening, right? You know, who were you feeding to figure out what was safe and what wasn't? I think they were using lead to close some of those cans for a while, right? There were
some issues. Yep. Trial and error. Good.
Yes.
Well, we'll come.
Accelerated from there, which you can explain.
Good. We'll come back and talk more about this because it's important, folks. It is. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about food,
preservation.
Food science with Kate Gilbert, because this is the time of year when you end up with that whole pile of cucumbers and you say, now what? I mean, refrigerator pickles and all that kind of things are good, but there are ways to can things, and it's a little tricky. We have learned how to do these things. We have.
Well, the first thing I want to do is, I want to do a little internet bashing here, and Kate and I have talked about this, and Lana and I have mentioned this on the radio before about, you know, there are ubiquitous amounts of recipes on the internet, and most young folks, when they want to learn to cook, they don't call up their grandmother. They didn't already learn it. Where do they go? To the internet, okay? Now, here's the problem with the internet recipes. When a cookbook is published, it has been recipe tested, which means the cookbook author writes the recipes and other people try and duplicate it and replicate it to make sure that the measurements are exact and that it's all clear. And then after that, there's also an editing process where editors, you know, comb through for little mistakes or things like that. So a cookbook that is properly produced, a mainstream cookbook from Joy of Cooking through anybody else that we read, and there are many, 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 it's a big industry, those books have been vetted very well. Whereas on the internet, anybody can go on, write a recipe, click, and it's out there. So, you know, I, for example, my favorite story is one of my housemates one time wanted to cook a curry from the internet. I come home and she goes, Donna, this is so hot. I can't even eat it. And I said, well, what did you use? So she shows me this recipe from that she got from the internet. And instead of a quarter teaspoon of cayenne, which would have probably been appropriate, it says a quarter tablespoon. And I had to say, Cassidy, there's an error in the recipe. Now, that was, you know, I mean, it made the dinner inedible, but nobody got sick and it didn't hurt anything. But that's just a small thing. Recipe writing, it is an art form, it is a science, and it's something that, you know, you just don't do off at the top of your head. It's work. So beware the internet. Now, I think some of this canning thing, it started, was a good example. Bon Appetit has a series of videos by this guy, Brad Leone, and I've watched some of them. He's a real hipster. He's fun. He's irreverent. You know, it's like new style for Bon Appetit. He's the bad boy in the kitchen. But he did an oopsie. He was teaching how to can lobster and mussels. Well, first of all, I have to say,
not a lot of call for that here in
no,
Iowa. But you know.
But and if you want to make a lobster and mussel thing, freeze it for goodness sake, you know. So he's canning it on the YouTube, and he hot water bathed it. No. And then they got called out for it, and he said, well, actually, it was a filming error. They edited out the part where I said, you know, pressure can, whatever. You know, that kind of set off some of this dialogue because he has a very popular YouTube series. And that comes from Bon Appetit. Hello. I mean, we're putting the blue ball people on the rack here. Bon Appetit did a no there. So, Kate, tell us what you think about internet recipes.
It's a complicated one to discuss because you want people to be baking and cooking at home.
Mm-hmm.
You want it to be as accessible as possible. And I ask my students where they get recipes or where they watch food. And it's the internet. It's YouTube.
Yep.
It's TikTok.
Yep.
It's all that. And so you need it to be
TikTok,
interesting
yes.
enough for them to bite and to get involved. And with most recipes, kind of like your curry example, it's going to be fine if the recipe is a little off. And so maybe it's worth it for them getting into cooking or baking. But canning is one of those where you say, no, there's just no, you know, do not follow recipes on the internet. USDA is going to be your best option here. But that's where, and we've talked about this before, I think, knowledge, general food knowledge on average on, you know, with our consumers is low. And so it's really hard to explain some of these complex issues.
Well, I think of it like medicine. You know, everybody can look up medical conditions on the internet, but you know what? If you're sick, you go to the doctor. You need a professional. Now, I'm a food service professional. I can read a recipe on the internet and tell you, oh, that's a good one. That one's okay. Or don't do this. Or this might be a better idea. Or, you know, this is impractical or whatever. But it does take some skill set, like finding anything on the internet. You're not supposed to believe everything you read on the internet.
Right. So let's compare a little bit, because I think the other thing that's going to help for background with this Fall Blue Book controversy is how do things get canned that show up on grocery store shelves?
Yes. How does that work?
And possibly why I would say the extension was a little miffed when Fall Blue Book didn't provide data back. So there are a lot of canned items on the grocery store shelves. Some of them are acidic, like your fruit. A lot of them are not, like your soup, right? And there's a lot of vegetables. So we know that a lot of these canned items have to process essentially under pressure. Now, frozen food has taken off. There's a lot of reason that you might choose frozen over canned, especially canned green peas, some of those lose some quality. But canning is still very much a good portion of the grocery store, right? So if you are a food company who is going to put those cans on the grocery store shelves, there's a couple things that have to happen. And there are a lot of regulations. There's a lot of detail. There's a lot of follow-up. But the first thing is that at least one person for each shift when this food is being made in the production facility has to be certified. So it's what I call canning school, and that's not the right name. I mean, it's better process control school. You have to go to
A certified person has to be well educated to know what they're doing, right?
Yes. And then there's a whole set of regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations under FDA subset of all the things that have to happen if you're canning. So every retort, which is essentially a large pressure canner, depending on how it's set up.
It's a machine called a retort. Yes.
Yeah.
Industrial machine.
So you have to check to make sure it got enough heat every time. The documentation on temperature and time and steam amount is all over the place. And if FDA shows up, you have to show all of that data for every batch ever made, right? Huh. So you have to keep all of these records. And before you're even allowed to make that food and put it in a can and sell it to the grocery store, you have to prove that the time and temperature that it's being heated to, based on that specific food product, that specific can size, that specific setup, is enough to kill the botulism or the clostridium botulinum spores that could cause the toxin. So rigorous.
And so these are fairly international standards, too. Like if you're buying imported food, same thing.
Yep. It might come under, you know, a slightly different regulation, but same sort of thing. So rigorous, documented, regulated.
Industrial.
Certified. A lot. And so the cases when we look at botulism are rarely ever from canned food in the grocery store versus canned food at home because somebody wasn't quite following all the instructions that they were supposed to. And so it's hard as a food scientist to look at all the data on how things are made in the grocery store and not want something fairly similar in terms of rigor and safety when you're making recommendations for people to can at home. You know, the whole point is you're taking the nutritious food you got out of the garden or out of the orchard and preserving it. And so you want to make sure it's safe. And so, coming back to Fall Blue Book and just answering some questions here or there, I think a lot of it comes down to just wanting some information to make sure that it is safe enough to recommend to consumers.
Speaking of safety, for canned foods, let's just talk about canned things in the supermarket. I guess canned things in our shelves, too. How long does this canning process last? Is there a past due date for things?
Oh, man.
A whole subject, eh?
This is where the Kate is a home canner and Kate is a food scientist will come up with a couple different answers. Obviously, if your seal ever breaks, you know, you don't have a tight seal on your can, it's got to go. Some seals will last longer than others. I think we found with the flat shortage for canning through the pandemic that there was some different quality with some of those flats. So as long as you're staying sealed, really keeping it in, you know, cool, dark place so you're not having too much breakdown of the, you know, colors, nutrients, that sort of thing, it'll last. It'll last a long time.
A long time as in one year, 100 years? 5 years.
Probably not 100 years, but certainly 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Most often you would be fine.
Depends on how often you clean out the pantry, right?
I think the recommendation is more like a year or two, just to be on the safe side and keep a high quality. But yeah, if you are canned under the conditions you were supposed to follow in terms of, you know, sterilizing jars and processing, it should stay good for quite some time.
Ha!
Is it the tops of the lids, which is that what you call flats?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Is the recommendation to only use those once? Is that seal good only used once?
Yeah.
For canning.
And, you know, I don't think you're going to get as good of seal the next time around. So it is a recommendation for this one.
Yeah, because it's really easy to ding it, to get a little rust on
nick
it,
in it.
I mean, you can look really, really close, and it may look, it's really easy to ding it.
So you can use the rings over, but not the flats. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So it's the flats that we've had a shortage of in the marketplace?
I've had a hard time finding the rings, too. Really interesting thing. Usually this time of year, getting canning rings, canning flats, canning whole jars is no big deal. But actually, this happened during the COVID event
last year too.
You couldn't get lids and rings for love or money, and I'm still having a real hard time finding
them. And when you do find
rings,
them, they're expensive.
Funny about that. The price goes. I sort of wonder. Okay, what country are we at war with that we can't get rings and lids? I mean, somebody someplace is producing them and not sell. Anyway, that's been my beef this year. But I'm making do. I am making do.
Yes. Well, as I'm going back to freezing again, I have to say, if the jars are so expensive and the work is so much, I think I'm just going to cook it up and freeze it.
But there's certain things that we have a taste for that come in jars. I'm thinking pickles. I don't think you can freeze pickles. Can you freeze pickles?
No, that's true. Yeah. No.
Your texture is going to go, I think, if you freeze them.
Yeah.
I can't imagine a frozen pickled beet either. So that's a pretty important one.
See, we have our bottom line here. Well, we have to do some of this if we want to get to our favorites.
Beets, however, you can store for quite a long time, you know. And you could make a fresh pickled beets even probably at Christmas.
Yeah. Making things up fresh is not a bad thing.
Now, cucumbers, I'm stumped there with that one.
It's not a bad thing. Good.
Oh, I suppose you could ferment them, Kate, couldn't you? Fermented cucumbers?
Yeah.
And that is a preservation technique for a certain period of time.
Yeah, for a certain period. But, it won't last you until cucumbers are ready again the next year, right? So it's a short term, but not a long term without canning. My refrigerator will last quite a while as well. But to really have them shelf stable, you got to can them.
The mysteries of it all. It is so nice to be able to learn new things. The kitchen is such a fun place to do things, and we get to eat this stuff too. I want to remind people that this is KHOI and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about us at www.khoifm.org. That's your community radio station. You can find out more about us and lots of other great programming too. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about canning with Kate Gilbert today. I want to mention two books that they're books Donna gave me, and I've kind of plowed through them, and they're good. They're about the way we eat now, there was a big change.
It's the history of food, industrialization, mostly in the 20th century, but it's kind of lets you know how we got to where we are from where our great-grandparents were.
Right.
And they're both well-written.
It's a good, they're
two
both
books.
Fun. Yeah, two books. The first one is Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back by Anne Felicius. And it's good. They both kind of cover the same
and
amount
these have,
of time.
These books have been around for, I don't know, at least 5 years or more. Yeah. So they're not like hot off the presses.
And the next one is kind of, it's the same time frame. It's called Perfection Salad, Women and Cooking at the Turn of the Century by Laura Shapiro. And
that one is a particularly good read. If you're only going to read one, that one's fun.
Both of these deal with the rise of the industrial food system, but also the rise of home economics, the importance of, there was a change in how women were in the kitchen, there was a change in how where people were living, there were more and more people that were not connected to farm communities, more people living in cities, and believe it or not, more people not having their own cooks and staff anymore. So all
and
of
their
a
own
sudden,
cows. And
all of a sudden, we needed advice, and not only home economics kind of started up at this time. The idea of how we feed ourselves, what's important.
Nutrition advice, and certainly, and this kind of, you know, mechanical advice of how hot it has to be, how long to cook it, how to, you know, safe. Yeah. Is it safe? Is it clean? Is it nutritious?
Good stuff. So Perfection Salad and Kitchen Literacy. Perfection Salad, I just want a little sidebar here. Perfection Salad has to do with home economics at the beginning of the last century was kind of redefining what women were in the kitchen and as heads of households. And there was a real struggle with keeping the idea of women as dainty, important people, keeping society together with special ways of doing things. And
there was also a concurrent battle with women needing to feel that they had their professional voices, which is part of, you know, incorporating home economics into the university systems to begin with, that it was not just something women naturally did. It was a profession worthy of respect.
Right.
And paid. Imagine that.
And it was a real cooperation between all of this new food systems coming out, all the new scientific information coming out.
And there was heavy pressure from industry
to sell certain things, like Crisco.
Crisco. Lard suddenly became unhealthy, dirty, nasty, and Crisco was pure.
Yeah.
Never mind that we found out 50 years later that it causes heart disease, but, you know.
A good read. A good read. And also, it was interesting, the idea of preparing the most dainty and lovely sort of dishes. Perfection Salad, like a lot of other things on the menu, was white. You made white things. You made chicken breasts with white sauce. You made cottage cheese salad with
Wonder
a white
bread.
White was good. And we hadn't really figured out any things about the whole grains or anything yet. But it's kind of an interesting read. Food changes as we find out more about things. And anyway, two books. Kitchen Literacy by Anne Felicius and Perfection Salad by Laura Shapiro. Kind of a nice look back. And we're still learning new things. I want to ask, there's canned things, which has all kinds of in the supermarket. We are used to that. But now there's irradiation of things, and things are freeze-dried and packed. And where are people responding to the irradiated foods? Kate, have you heard anything about that? Is that a big deal now?
So I want to back up and just throw out one more fact, and then we'll speed up, because there are some things changing in processing right now that are pretty interesting. But I like that you bring up Perfection Salad and kind of that turn of the century and how food changed, because that's really about the time that the discipline of food science came around. It was formed somewhere in 1939, 1940, And it was around canning. You know, quite frankly, it was how to make sure that information is being sent to the consumers so that they make safe food at home. So I think it's kind of a fun tie-in together. And things have progressed, right? Well, I don't know, the food industry is complex. It's changed a lot. We've learned some, made improvements. The big push now is to have fewer ingredients in food and process less. But that can be a challenge when we're talking about making sure food is safe. And so there's a lot of work being done on what technologies, and it can often be referred to as hurdles, but essentially instead of just heat for a certain amount of time, you might use a certain amount of salt or sugar to lower your water activity, the amount of water that's present for bacteria to grow. You might add a more natural preservative so that you're still trying to get a fresh product as best you can, but also have the same shelf life, and it can be quite a challenge. Irradiation never really took off that much, so there's not that many foods that are irradiated. The ones that are irradiated are typically herbs and spices. They're ones that can have a pretty high bacteria load. It doesn't all make you sick necessarily, but spoilage is possible. And so if you heated them up, you're going to lose the flavor, right? You could definitely deteriorate. And so irradiation gets used for a lot of those things.
Especially imported herbs and spices, because they're looking, you know, at pests and things that travel across borders through foods.
Right. Yeah, and all these things are out in the elements, right? I mean, cinnamon is bark.
Yep.
They're outside.
Yeah, it's leaves and roots and stuff like that. Yeah.
And you typically want to add them to their food and not worry about how much heat they need. So that's really where we've seen irradiation, and I think it's a good use of the technology for those ingredients.
Yeah, I think it's pretty accepted. And I would guess that you can count on that most of the herbs and spices that you're buying are irradiated.
Yep, that's a pretty safe.
Yeah.
So Kate, are you canning or putting food by? What kind of things are you doing this time of year? Do you have a special recipe that you like to put away because nothing else will do?
Well, one of my favorites is crabapple butter. We actually made it a few weeks ago. Crabapples are kind of a pain to pick. Our tree's old. It's a little too tall. But juice them so you can make jelly from the juice, and then you put them through the sieve like you would make an applesauce, and you get this really pretty red butter that you heat up. You add a little bit of almond extract, and it is fantastic on toast. So
sugar.
There I was.
Do you have to? It's crab apple, so you need sugar, right?
Yep, you need some sugar. Need some sugar in there as well. But you know, pretty easy to make, and it is worth climbing on the ladder and getting hit in the head with crab apples for that to make that because it's so good.
See, everybody has a favorite. I like that, and putting a little almond extract. What a good idea!
You can hot pack that, right?
Yep, hot pack. So can with hot water bath.
So, okay, we didn't say this. So hot pack is when you've boiled your jars and they're sterilized and the lids, right? And then your jelly or jam or marmalade or whatever is also very, very hot. Label the hot jelly or jam into the pre-sterilized, still hot jar, and you put the flat part of the lid on, and then you let it cool on the shelf, and when it goes pings or dings or whatever you want to call it, it has a little dimple in it. It means it has contracted as it cools, and then that pushes any little bit of air out and you're good. That's called hot packing.
So hot pack, and usually it depends on the recipe. Usually hot pack still has some hot water bath canning to it. Some does not, some does. But it doesn't take as much because everything was, your jars were sterilized and still hot.
Yep. I've kind of learned to enjoy the dance in the kitchen of keeping things hot, clean, quick. It's kind of a process, but it's good. You made some crab apple butter, and this year I made pear butter because this time of year.
And I made plum butter.
And you made plum butter. People just bring us things, or they share things, or say, I've got this tree, and they share the bounty. It's a wonderful time of year. Well, do you have anything else to say, Kate, about canning, about putting food by, about ISU home economics? We're kind of wrapping up here.
Yes, well, you know, we've talked about clustering batch lineup, and that does sound kind of scary, but I don't want to stop anybody from canning, right? So
exactly.
If you want to use the bulk book for most things, it's probably fine. We're waiting on data, but it's probably fine. When in doubt, go to the USDA home canning. There's lots of recipes. You can always double check and give it a try, because it does take time. You know, we haven't convinced Donna to can more here, but you will enjoy it in the winter. You will enjoy
yes.
it later on.
It's lovely.
So don't give up, right? It's still scientifically proven. We just have to be careful on our resources that we use.
Great. Great. Thank you for being with us today, Kate. We covered a lot of ground, and I think we dealt with the ball blue book kerfuffle just fine. Thanks. Thanks for being here, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. You can hear our show Tuesdays at noon. We repeat at 7 p.m. or anytime at khoifm.org. We had music today, English country dance music by the band Persons of Quality. Oh, yes. And we'll be going out with a bit of a waltz, because what a nice thing to do as you're canning. Just waltz around the kitchen there. Yeah. Support this fine radio station. And thanks for joining us. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had fine engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.